Ground Cover News is a nonprofit street paper that was founded in April 2010 as a means to empower low-income persons to make the transitions from homeless to housed and from jobless to employed. Vendors purchase each copy of the Ground Cover News regular edition at our office for 50 cents. This money goes towards production costs. Vendors work selling the paper on the street for $2, keeping all income and tips from each sale. This audio production was made possible by the Ann Arbor District Library, recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios. If you consistently enjoy Ground Cover Speaks, continuing to buy physical newspapers from Ground Cover vendors ensures that we can sustain production. The physical paper and in-person interaction is at the heart of our work. You can find the link to our next audio recording in the upcoming print issue of Ground Cover News. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to our print advertisers, the People's Food Co-op, St. Francis of Assisi Parish, First Baptist Church, Bethlehem United Church of Christ, the Office of Community and Economic Development, Cineholic, Art on a Journey, Ann Arbor for Public Power, Four Directions, and the Ypsilanti Food Co-op.
Ground Cover Art Intel, Party Time, Walk Through the Art Fair. Cindy Gear, Ground Cover Vendor Number 279. My journey through the Ann Arbor Art Fair, July 18th through the 20th, 2024, was very exciting and much anticipated. Art is loved in this town, and mural art has been exploding over the past 5 years. One cannot drive anywhere in Ann Arbor without seeing large art installations on buildings and underpasses. There are new flower paintings on the bridge and underpass near Delana Center and on the nearby railroad bridge on Miller Ave. This was finished during the art fair this year. See The Art of Gentrification in July 12th, Ground Cover News. This year, walking along the downtown Main Street Art Fair, I saw many different kinds of art. Two-dimensional, three-dimensional, jewelry, and more. My personal favorite has always been animals from an artist named Mr. Fawn, who is always in the same location. He does wonderful images of so many different animals, as well as flowers, including my favorite, pandas, dragons, and roses. As I walked up Liberty Street, I saw much color this year, from abstract painting to colored blown glass and vibrant illustrations of fantasy scenes. I was awestruck with the detail in much of the work this year. Hours upon hours of love goes into some of the work, and the price does not do it justice. What I find hard for artists is the level at which art is graded by price. What I see as cheap art is by far priced out of a common person's range, and yet what is considered cheap art is much wonderful to look at and needs to be in a higher price range. The argument has always been over what art is truly worth, and some artists struggle with this forever. Almost to the end of Liberty Street, I came upon the political and nonprofit organization section from social justice issues, religion, and electoral politicians. What I chose to get was the free candy they gave out. Fun, fun, yum, yum. I walk up this to State Street and turn right. This is where I found the African American art bead vendor. He remembers me from last year, and so I got some wonderful beads. As a Native American, it's hard to come by beads now without paying a huge amount. Each vendor on State Street is fun to see, from discount clothing to wonderful food. As I walk down to William Street, I chose to look at the different precious gems and metalwork who creates total custom-made art, one-of-a-kind pieces. Each jeweler was unique. Some were totally modern, while others had a time period attached to them, such as the 1800s. I wandered up past University of Michigan Law School, and this one artist stuck out like no other. She was a Fimo artist. Fimo is a type of clay with very vibrant colors, and being a colorist myself, I fell in love. She had just about everything someone could want, from magnets to pins, freestanding caricatures to sculpture that looked like they were right out of a Jim Henson Muppets movie. She had it all. This was, for me, the ultimate fun this year. Each artist touched me with their artwork, and as I wandered down a lonely path on a side street, I found the hat that has eluded me for years. This vendor artist was wonderful, vibrant color hats for sale. I chose to get a black one, as others looked like Indiana Jones was ready to show up. It was fun to see the large variety of hats at this booth. My art fair was full of fun and colors and new ideas. I hope you had as much fun as I did this year. 2025 Art Fair, here we come.
Hello, everyone. My name is Hosea Hill. I am ground cover vendor number 532, and I'm reading my article from the August 9th, 2024 edition of Ground Cover Newspaper. Title of my article is Dave Bing, NBA Hall of Famer. David Dave Bing played 9 seasons for the Detroit Pistons, 2 seasons with the Washington Bullets, and 1 season with the Boston Celtics. According to HoopHaw.com, located in Springfield, Massachusetts, the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame is an independent nonprofit 501 organization dedicated to promoting, preserving, and celebrating the game of basketball at every level. The Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame is named after John Naismith, the inventor of basketball. Everything that I've ever done, I have attacked it, Bing said, according to the Detroit Free Press in November 2020. Leaders are readers, and Dave Bing certainly read often on long road trips during his NBA career. In 1989, he became involved in politics in Detroit because the city announced plans to cancel all sports programs in the public schools due to budget cutbacks. He launched a campaign that raised money to save the programs. He was elected to replace former mayor Kwame Kilpatrick in 2009. And was reelected for a full term. He is an inspiration to all because he's a good example of a person changing careers and being successful at both careers. Thank you and have a good day.
The title of this story is Houston Has Success with Housing First Homeless Strategy. And the writer is Will Shakespeare of Grand Cover News. We begin. CBS Sunday morning broadcast on April 14 told the story of Houston's housing first model. The story, narrated by reporter Martha Techner, was titled Inside Houston's Successful Strategy to Reduce Homelessness. Kelly Young, the president of the Coalition for the Homeless of Houston, Harris County, said that the housing first model, which was implemented in Houston, should be followed by other cities in the nation. She noted, "We were one of the worst in the nation to begin with in 2011 and 2012. Since then, homelessness is down 63% in the greater Houston area, and more than 30,000 people have been housed." Techner talked to many of the organizers and beneficiaries of Houston's Housing First program. How did they do it? Instead of having dozens of homeless advocacy groups work separately on the services or programs they provide to the homeless, the committee chose to create an umbrella organization known as The Way Home. This new organization is collaborative and is now called the Coalition for the Homeless of Houston-Harris County. The coalition agreed to have one president and CEO, Kelly Young, one project communication and strategy director, Mandy Chapman, mayor special assistant on homelessness, Mark Etchebom, and a dedicated board. What is Housing First? Like the Y Foundation, Housing First of Metropolitan Helsinki, Finland, Houston's The Way Home umbrella totally embraced the concepts and applications of Housing First. The National Alliance to End Homelessness provide a clear concept and definition of housing first. In a publication dated March 20th, 2022, Housing First is a homeless assistance approach that prioritizes providing permanent housing to people experiencing homelessness. Fourth, ending their homelessness and serving as a platform for which they can pursue personal goals and improve the quality of their life. This approach is guided by the belief that people need basic necessities like food and a place to live before attending to anything less critical, such as getting a job, budgeting properly, or tackling substance use issues. Additionally, Housing First is based on the understanding that client choice is valuable in housing selection and supportive service participation, and that exercising that choice is likely to reduce a client more successful in remaining housed and improving their lives. The publication observes the differences between Housing First and other approaches. It states, Housing First does not require people experiencing homelessness to address all of their problems, including behavioral health problems, or to graduate through a series of service programs before they can access housing. Housing First does not mandate participation in services either before obtaining housing or in order to retain housing. The Housing First approach views housing as the foundation for life improvement and enables access to permanent housing. The Housing First concept discussed above is a generic concept definition. The U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department's report titled Housing First in Permanent Supportive Housing attempted to provide a more concise definition of Housing First. HUD stated, Housing First is an approach to quickly and successfully connect individuals and families experiencing homelessness to permanent housing without preconditions and barriers to entry, such as sobriety, treatment, or service participation requirements. Supportive services are offered to maximize housing stability and prevent returns to homelessness, as opposed to addressing treatment goals prior to permanent housing entering. On July 14, 2022, writer Robert Davis of the online magazine Invisible People, stated, "The housing first was first pioneered in the U.S. in the 1990s. It was developed by a professor named Dr. Sam Semberis. Housing first is premised on the principles: A, homelessness is first and foremost a housing crisis and can be addressed through provision of safe and affordable housing. B, all people experiencing homelessness, regardless of their housing history and duration of homelessness, can achieve housing stability in permanent housing. Some may need very little support for a brief period of time, while others may need more intensive and long-term supports. Everyone is housing ready. Sobriety, compliance in treatment, or even non-criminal histories are not necessary to succeed in housing. Rather, homelessness programs and housing providers must be consumer ready. C, many people experience improvement in quality of life in the areas of health, mental health, substance use, and employment as a result of obtaining housing. D, people experiencing homelessness have the right to self-determination and should be treated with dignity and respect. E, the exact configuration of housing and services depends upon the needs and preferences of the population. Subtitle here is Houston's Housing First Implementation Strategy. As noted in the introductory paragraphs, Houston was able to convince service and treatment providers, nonprofit philanthropy groups, and other homeless advocacy centers in the community to join a coalition known as the Coalition for the Homeless of Houston-Harris County. Houston's next strategic move was to go all in by adopting the key concepts and principles of housing first. Techner of CBS Morning News talked to the newly housed individuals and families. She talked to outreach coordinators at some homeless encampments who use tracking device to locate individuals with various needs, including permanent housing. She also talked to Young and the Housing First architect for the way home community umbrella. Mandy Chapman. Techner noted that Chapman now advises other cities on how to replicate it, among them Dallas, New Orleans, and Oklahoma City. In her conversation with Techner, Chapman observed, "Our natural instinct when we see homelessness increasing is to hire more outreach workers and to build more shelters, beds. The idea that if you have no permanent place to live, that you are also going to be able to transform and tackle complex mental health issues, addiction issues, complex financial issues. It's just unrealistic." CBS Morning, Sunday Morning also reported that Houston has dismantled 127 homeless encampments, but only after housing had been found for all the occupants. So far this year, The Way Home has already housed more than 750 people. It helps that the city, unlike many, has a supply of relatively affordable apartments, and that it was able to use roughly $100 million in COVID aid to help pay for rentals on top of its other homeless relief dollars. But Houston's message is this: what's really essential to success is committing to homes, not just managing homelessness. Another title, subtitle: Impacts and Lessons for Cities. Community impacts of Houston's Harris County housing first implementation are quite impressive, and we have bullet points to express them. 32,000 homeless people permanently housed since 2012 by the partners of The Way Home. 90% success rate for local housing programs. That means people don't return to homelessness within 2 years. 22,300 unique people who accessed homeless assistance in 2022. $179 million in public funding in 2023. $50 million in HOS Continuum of Care awarded to partners of The Way Home in 2023. Net zero veteran homelessness in Harris County, Houston metro area. Over 1.4 million awarded to The Way Home in 2024 for homeless youth. On February 15th, 2024, Grand Cover News published an article titled "Homelessness is a National Crisis in America." Subtitle is "Lessons from Finland's Housing First Policies." Finland native Alexandra Granberg shared her knowledge of Finland Helsinki's housing first model with our local readers. Many other cities have tried to implement the housing first model with varying degrees of success and failure. Atlanta says that they succeeded in reducing the community's homeless population by 40% using the housing first approach. Dallas and Salt Lake City saw some improvements. However, Los Angeles is still searching for a significant improvement after implementing the housing first strategy. Grand Rapids, Kent County Coalition to End Homelessness, which includes more than 60 continuum of care partners, recently plans to house 100 chronically homeless people within 100 days. Houston's housing first success story should resonate with local and state government leaders who are searching for durable solutions to their challenges with unhoused, unsheltered, and growing street homelessness. Houston presents a good case study. National Alliance to End Homelessness research has shown that housing first is more cost-effective than traditional rapid housing programs. Washtenaw County is not as large an urban county as Harris County. However, Ann Arbor, the county seat, lacks affordable housing. Rent inflation continues to be too high. Ypsilanti is somewhat more affordable, but the cost of housing is rising there too. Local and state governments should implement housing first policies, but they will likely need economic support from the federal government to make substantial headway. Thank you, and have a nice day.
Section 86, Housing Choice Voucher Waitlist Closes in Michigan, by Robbie February, Ground Cover Contributor. Last month, the waiting list for Section 8 housing vouchers closed statewide. No new applications will be taken, and existing renewals will not happen. the waiting list will be dropped entirely. This leaves some people who have been anxiously waiting for their spot for years feeling frustrated. The multi-year process of checking in, preparing paperwork, meeting case managers can be a daunting effort. Two friends of mine are going through this process, Steve and Amy. They're navigating the challenging terrain of the Michigan State Housing Development Authority, otherwise known as MISHDA, Housing Choice Voucher Program, otherwise known as HCV. Both programs are commonly known as Section 8. This program is essential for providing affordable housing to low-income residents, but the process can be fraught with difficulties, especially with the complexities of waiting of the waiting list in Washtenaw County. The MISHDA Housing Choice Voucher Program operates on a waiting list system to manage the demand for affordable housing. In Washtenaw County, where the need is high, this waiting list can extend over several years. This lengthy wait often leads to considerable confusion and frustration for those who are seeking assistance. According to the county's website, there are over 2,400 vouchers administered in Washtenaw County in 2023, and 140 of those are reserved for homeless households. One major issue is the waiting list is dynamic rather than static. Applicants are placed on the list based on their application date and need, but changes can occur, including additions or removals based on various criteria. This can make it difficult for applicants to understand their current standing and predict when they might need and receive assistance. Due to budget constraints, the HCV program will not release any new vouchers for the foreseeable future. During this time, MISHDA will close all HCV waitlists to new additions starting July 1st, 2024, and the waitlist will remain closed until the budget allows for new vouchers to be released. Budget shortfalls from the federal government, coupled with rising housing costs, have created a deficit in the program. Misunderstandings. Complicating this process further are the project preferences that influence the applicant's waiting list status. MISHDA administers the HCV program with various housing projects and landlords, each with their own criteria for accepting tenants. Preferences may prioritize certain demographics, such as veterans or individuals with disabilities, which can affect applicants' placement on the waiting list. Steve shared his frustration with the lack of clarity in the process. We were living at Purple House in the winter for a few days a week. That's when we got our first letter about being kicked off the list. I'm not used to any of this craziness. I don't know how any of this works. Amy followed up. We felt defeated, like nobody cares, except for people like Peggy Lynch, the founder of Mercy House, and certain people at Delana's. It's stupid. I owned a trailer and tried to apply for Section 8. I should have totally eliminated this process. I could have saved my place. Seriously, Amy continued, I've had like 23 teeth taken out in emergency surgery this month. Recovering in my car is hard. We are so thankful for the car, but I have neuropathy. Have you ever experienced waking up in the winter with burning hot feet, like someone has a fudging torch to your feet because of Peggy? No lie, this pain can be significantly reduced. Well, it's shitty that someone has to recover from surgery sleeping on a car seat, I replied. Duh, Amy and Steve say in unison. Administrative challenges and communication barriers. Administrative challenges within MISHDA itself can further contribute to the difficulties. Bureaucratic processes can create barriers to effective communication and management on the waiting list. Many applicants, including Steve and Amy, report struggles with reaching MISHDA staff, receiving timely responses, or understanding the instructions provided. I felt like we had no support from the county, Steve noted. MISHDA's website and online resources, while useful, might not always be up-to-date or comprehensive. Applicants often rely on these resources for guidance, but outdated information can lead to misunderstandings about the waiting list process. The people who help locally are the Delana Center and HAWC, which is HAWC's Housing Access for Washtenaw County. Steve and Amy stayed in their car often last winter. They not only suffered from below freezing temperatures, but they were also harassed by law enforcement. Steve said, "We were targeted by the police in November. We received multiple tickets on back-to-back days while caring for a friend sleeping in our car. You get one ticket and you can't afford to pay, and then you get a late fee, then your tags are expired and you can't catch up with them. Even if we're homeless, we still pay taxes. These $100 tickets keep adding up. It's kept Amy and I in a precarious situation for months. The stress of it has caused few medical concerns. We've had 4 surgeries between the two of us in the last 30 days. This isn't any way to heal, and it'll cause us years of recovery that could have been prevented." Amy reaches out to Steve Hand, and we continue the interview. I met Steve in first grade, Amy added. I was married for 15 years with two kids. My husband passed away in 2015. My life's been a mess since. I was 35 when he died. We had no insurance, nothing. I had a trailer in Wixom. Steve and I stayed in touch and started traveling together in November 2022. We were in the same situation. We were fudged, and let's say we're still fudged. We chose to find shelter together compared to two bad separate home situations. Steve said, the first letter we got from Mishta stated that it was determined that we were housed. I was like, when? How in the fudge did anyone determine we were housed? We followed up with them, and I felt the community was turning on me. We're in a lot of contact with Path, or maybe some shit got lost in the shuffle. Last year, Path would come out and check on us. This year, I feel like we have no support from the county. Addressing the confusion. To address these issues in Washtenaw County, several measures could be considered. 1. Improve mail handling. Ensuring reliable mail delivery for shelters like the Delanda Center is crucial. MISHTA should work with these facilities to resolve mail issues and explore alternative communication methods, such as digital notifications or secure online portals. 2. Improve communication. The HCV program should improve its communication strategies by providing clear, detailed instructions and updates about the waiting list process. Enhancing accessibility through multiple communication channels would also be beneficial. 3. Clarify project preferences. Offering transparent information about project preferences and criteria would help applicants understand how these factors affect their waiting list status. Clear guidelines can aid applicants in making more informed decisions. 4. Simplifying administrative processes. This will improve efficiency and reduce delays. Investing in technology and staff training may enhance waitlist management and applicant experience. 5. Provide educational resources. Offering workshops or resources to educate applicants about the waiting list process, their rights, and available options can empower them to navigate the system more effectively. By tackling these areas, MISHTA can better support applicants like Steve and Amy, reducing the stress and uncertainty associated with the waiting list, and ultimately providing more effective and equitable affordable housing assistance. MISHTA will continue to provide rental assistance on behalf of current HCV participants as their program participation is not impacted by the shortfall. MISHTA may continue to assist families in these programs, project-based voucher programs, Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing programs, and the Stability Voucher Program. People who are seeking publicly funded housing should take heart. Many other states have suspended their waiting lists only to reopen them again. New York recently reopened a closed waiting list. Over 200,000 people applied for less than 3,000 vouchers, but there are other opportunities as well. Steve adds on a personal note, I can still beat up some of these younger guys on the disc golf course. When I'm done, I'll whip him up a tasty dish of Stevie sauce served on my favorite disc. His humor underscores the resilience and determination that keep him and Amy going despite the challenges they face.
First year of care-based safety, workshop, community building. Place-based response. On June 18, the Wayne Police Department murdered John Zook Jr. He called the police for help during a mental health crisis, and they responded by shooting him 6 times. On July 6, the Sangamon County Sheriff's Department in Springfield, Illinois, murdered Sonya Massey in her own kitchen after she called 911 to report a possible intruder in her home. We hear stories like this far too often when it comes to police and ordinary citizens in distress. Care-Based Safety is an unarmed response organization established in September 2023. Their main objectives and purpose is to keep people of color, indigenous, and undocumented and unhoused LGBTQIA+ people using drugs and or those experiencing mental health struggles safe by addressing conflicts such as arguments, disagreements, basic first aid, wound care, wellness checks, overdose prevention, reversal, and aftercare, noise complaints and neighbors' concern, distress related in mental health and other stressors. Care-Based Safety is building a community response program that brings loving, unarmed support to people directly impacted by structural violence. The Ypsilanti Care-Based Response Pilot Program has been operating throughout the summer in the downtown area. They work out of 16 South Washington Street in partnership with Growing Hope and Fed Up Ministries to respond to conflicts and troubling issues that might occur in the downtown area. Care Based to Safety plans to serve the most vulnerable in Ann Arbor area as well, but on December 18, 2023, Ann Arbor voted to cancel their most recent request for proposal, RFP, for an unarmed response program. Care Based to Safety was the only organization to submit a proposal of this RFP, so Ann Arbor effectively rejected CBS when they canceled it. The Ann Arbor City Council received many negative complaints from CBS supporters but didn't change its vote. Note that Care Based to Safety is the first and only unarmed response organization in the state. I talked to Washtenaw County native Liz Kennedy, the director who leads operations and culture work at Care Based to Safety. How do you like your job at CBS? I asked her. She said, I love it. It is an amazing opportunity to bring a pure, non-police, community-led program here in Ypsilanti. I grew up in the Washtenaw County area, and I lost a lot of loved ones to overdoses, violence, and incarceration over the years. I myself am a survivor, so it is really a humbling experience to be able to support and bring a program like this to life because I feel we as a community need more options, more tools in the toolbox when it comes to getting crisis care and healing support. I also asked her, why does the community need CBS? She answered, the community we serve asks for CBS. We are a very diverse group of community leaders who work, live, and play in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor and the wider Washtenaw County community. We are the representatives of people who are most impacted by police and all state violence, like people of color, trans, queer, and those suffering from mental health issues. And together, we are developing a care-based system for all. Care-based safety is created by us and for us. I also had a chance to talk to community building leader Cherie Wonder. The pilot program is a place-based pilot, meaning we will be in the downtown area, and if any crisis or conflicts is brought to our attention, we will respond from there, not in the response to a phone number. Due to, in part, this is a capacity issue because we don't have the people or funding to have an outward-facing phone number that would allow us to respond to a larger geographical area. But also, there is a particular need in this area, so many people hang out downtown. People with interacting identities, peoples of color, homeless, with alcohol and substance abuse, leaving many in our community vulnerable to over-policing and the penal system. The pilot program is largely about community building. When we co-created Care-Based Safety through listening sessions and surveys, we heard over and over that 50% of the work should be about community building. Building trust and a safe net in our community is the only way for it to be successful, and that those who respond to whatever situations that might occur in our community should be from the community. We plan to have days where we have fun, dance parties, karaoke, rap contests, and we have cornhole and a giant jingle game. And also, we'll be on the lookout for really hot days for us to host cooling centers for those who need to escape the harsh summer heat. We also hope people will give monetary donations and or their time and services so we can better help our community with resources needed. Visit our website to donate and for more information on how to get involved at carebasedsafety.org. For those who need our services, we will be at 16 South Washington Street every Wednesday and Thursday from 5 to 9 p.m. throughout the summer. Note, Wellness Wednesdays includes haircut, foot care, and more. Thursday fun days include music, dance, and games. Be safe and have a great summer.
I'm Anthony Smith, and this is an article I wrote entitled Operation Robin Rescue, Do's and Don'ts. I was on my way to the library. I had some applications to follow up on, and I was going to orate my article for the Ground Cover Speaks podcast. I was just making my way as I usually do, shouting obscenities at passers-by and generally being offensive, when I saw a baby bird on the ground. This little bird didn't look happy. I looked up, and I saw the nest, which was way too high. I couldn't reach it. I was faced with a choice. I could give up my plans for the morning or say, "That's life in the big city," to that poor little bird and keep on moving. I picked up the little bird, and I wondered what to do. I couldn't leave him to the ants. The life of a bird is short enough, and they would get there soon enough. A man walked up by a pickup truck nearby, and I asked him if he would help. He said yes, but when we examined the area below the nest site, his truck was not going to fit. "Oy vey," he said with a sad look on his face. He wanted to help, but the planters by the tree were not going to move. Those planters have to weigh tons. So I thanked the man, and I figured maybe someone at the ground cover office might help. They sure weren't expecting me to walk into the office at that time, and definitely not with some kind of dang baby bird, but I did it anyway. I thought maybe there would be a stepladder or something we could get. Maybe many people were apprehensive about the bird's fate. Many said, "You touched it, now the mama bird will reject it," and I explained, "If I didn't, the poor bird was destined to be ant food, so I had to try." It turns out I did the right thing. I went outside the office and turned over rocks till I found a grub and two worms. I didn't go full-on mama bird and chew them up, but I did smash them a bit. The bird bros had this to say: "If you find a baby bird, it likely does not need your help unless it's featherless or has its eyes closed. These birds are nestlings and aren't ready to leave the nest yet. If you can locate the nest nearby, the best thing to do is simply place the nestling back in the nest. If you cannot locate the nest, leave the nestling where you found it or move it to a shaded area. The parents will come back. Don't worry. Your scent will not deter the parents." As birds get bigger, they outgrow the nests and need room to move around, flap their wings, and learn to fly. These more developed birds are fledglings, and they can easily be identified by their more developed feathers. They can hop and flutter on their own. Fledglings don't need help. Their parents are nearby and still caring for them. Be sure to give them plenty of space. This from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It is important to know the stages of a bird. When they first leave the nest, it might be awkward. My guy seemed like late stage two to me. Baby birds go through three stages. Hatchlings, usually 0 to 3 days old. It hasn't opened its eyes, and many have wisps of down on its body. It's not ready to leave the nest. Nestling, usually between 3 to 13 days old. Its eyes are open, and its wing feathers may look like tubes because they've yet to break through their protective sheaths. It's not ready to leave the nest. Fledgling, 13 to 14 days old or older.
This bird is fully feathered. Its wings and tail may be short, and it may not be a great flyer, but it can walk, hop, or flutter. It has left the nest, though its parents may be nearby taking good care of it. When you come upon a hatchling or a nestling on the ground, look for a nest in the area. It's likely to be within a few yards. Then follow these steps. Put on gloves, or if you don't have gloves, wash your hands. Gently pick up the baby bird and place it back into the nest. Note, if the nest has been damaged or is too high to reach, you can place the bird in a woven basket from your local garden store or hang it on a low branch. A basket looks to a bird like a natural nest, and the weave design will allow rainwater to drain through it and prevent the baby bird from drowning. Watch from a distance to see if the parents come back to the nest. This may take a few hours, so if you can't stay, try and come back later that day to check. If the parent bird doesn't return to the nest, or you can't find the nest, using gloved or clean hands, place the bird in a container, e.g. a shoebox lined with soft cloth. You can use paper towels, a baby blanket, or a piece of clothing. 2, if you have a heating pad, place it on the lowest setting and put it under the soft bedding to keep the baby bird warm. A hot water bottle also works well. 3, place the box with the baby bird in the dark, quiet, away from people and pets. Don't give the bird food or water. 5, contact your local wildlife rehabilitation center to arrange for further care. I left the ground cover office with the bird in a blue laundry container. I'd squished a few worms and a grub. I was this bird's mommy now. A mommy from hell. I had a chair, and one of the ground cover reporters came with me in case I needed a hand. She was so good, the Native American lady. I was grateful for her because my plan involved balancing on a chair made during the Eisenhower administration. As luck would have it, things worked out perfectly. When we arrived at the corner, I soon found out that the chair was not going to cut it. So I had the idea of trying the library. The librarian was helpful, but no one was available to help. So I returned to the scene. The little bird was chirping, and its mother stood a distance away, calmly watching the situation. Its little mouth opened wide and its eyes squinted hard, so I gave it the last of the worms while I figured what to do. It was then birdie lightning struck. Across the street there were two guys, one with a ladder of just the right size and another with a pull cart. I yelled and I gesticulated wildly as I ran across the street. The look on their faces was definitely one of trepidation. That all changed when I told them the situation. They gladly came to aid in my mission of mercy. We set up the ladder and got to business during the time I learned that the pair worked for the city, hanging banners on street lamps and putting up posters. Very likely you have passed their work many times. They may not paint the art for the pieces they hang, But if not for them and their co-workers, the many beautiful pieces would not be hung so and changed with good regularity. In an instant, the heroes of this story turned from regular working guys into an elite bird rescue team. As a backup, I had the number of the nature rehab people on deck. But as you will see in this film, and if you type this in, https://files.catbox.mo/5m22x3.mp4, you should be able to see the footage of when we put the little guy back in his nest. It's darling footage. Catbox Mo is a file-saving site, so you know. Everything worked out. A few days on, everything looked fine. I've checked, and no dead birdie. I did see their mother catching worms the next day, and I heard the wee birds near ravenous peeping. As I was doing the final revisiting of this piece, I had another interesting bird experience. And this is the one that's reflected on the cover here. It's the image with my name underneath it. I had another interesting experience, this time with a fledgling, the last stage of baby birds. It landed on my back and proceeded to chirp in my ears for like 10 minutes. In this stage of bird development, the bird can fly, but they're still learning. A nice lady wanted to keep the bird because she thought it was lost. Enjoy and be kind to our feathered friends. Thank you very much.